This is your KVNF Regional Newscast for Thursday, August 6th. I'm Audra McCabe. Matra City Council unanimously passed an ordinance establishing a 15-mile-per-hour speed limit for all e-bike riders. This speed limit applies to riding on sidewalks, trails, and pedestrian multi-use paths within Montrose's 38 municipal parks and prohibits off-trail riding. The ordinance also creates a new definition of classless electric-assisted vehicles, those with motors exceeding 750 watts or top speeds above 28 miles per hour, and broadly prohibits their operation on city streets and paths. Violations are Class A traffic infractions with fines of $15 to $100. The ordinance specifically addresses a gap in state law that has left high-powered e-bikes and similar devices in a legal gray zone. Police Chief Blaine Hall announced a public education campaign already underway introducing e-bike safety in school PE classes in September. Public comment was extensive and supportive, with multiple residents describing near-miss incidents with fast-moving e-bikes on Montrose trails and roads. Questions were raised about nighttime visibility, pushing riders off paths onto streets, and whether fines are sufficient deterrent. A second reading will be required before the ordinance takes effect. The federal government recently awarded a $529 million contract to the private prison company Geo Group to operate a new immigration detention center in Hudson, Colorado. But Geo Group is only one piece of the picture. While the company will operate the facility, another company actually owns the building and stands to profit from the lease. For Rocky Mountain Community Radio, KGNU's Abby O'Brien spoke with reporter Logan Davis, who has written about this in the Colorado Times Recorder. His investigation shows that the landlord has ties not only to the detention center, but also to residential properties in the Denver area.
Logan, you've been following sort of the economic transactions associated with this massive immigration crackdown for the past 18 months. Your article is headlined, ICE's new landlord might be your landlord too, and it calls our attention to the company making money by renting out the building to Geo. Tell us about that company.
Yes, absolutely. We've really tried to follow the profiteering here. I personally suspect that's the sort of thing that won't necessarily age well, or I would hope that it's not the sort of thing that would age well. So whenever there's a new angle of this, we've really been interested in seeing where that money is going. Geo is obviously a big winner here. Their profits went up 700% year over year. And now the acting director of ICE is a former longtime Geo employee. So there's definitely this private sector aspect to all of this. Geo will be opening the Hudson facility, which is owned by a company named Highlands Real Estate Investment Trust, or Highlands REIT. Highlands REIT is based in Illinois, but they have for a number of years owned the facility of the closed Hudson Correctional Center up in northeast of the city. Hudson, I think, has gotten more press as a town from this than it has pretty much anything else combined. So a lot of people don't know where it is because it's about the size of a postage stamp. But it's going in up there. Hudson Highlands is the company that owns this facility. And for years, since it closed as a prison in 2014, it's just kind of been mothballed. About 6 months ago, Geo got a six-month contract to reopen it. And then that never happened. Now ICE is trying to expand its capacity really quickly. We're in the middle of this 30-day sprint in which they were going to try to bring about 5,000 new detention beds online, and well over 1,000 of those are going to be in Hudson. So the facility is now going to be opening, and this Illinois-based real estate investment trust is going to be making about $11.5 million a year from it.
Say that number again.
$11.5 million. What's interesting about that number, the rent they are charging annually, once the facility is opened, the rent that Geo will have to pay Highlands per month, rather, is $958,333.33, which over 12 months adds up to just $4 shy of $11.5 million. It's $11,499,996. So it's very close.
So when we talk about real estate companies benefiting from this immigration crackdown, you make the point that Highlands REIT might be your landlord, listener, listening right now. It owns several apartment buildings in Denver. Tell us about Highlands REIT's role as the owner of residential places, apartment buildings that might be in our neighborhoods.
Absolutely. They own 8 residential buildings in Denver. They have some other subsidiaries that own a few in other states, but their holdings here are concentrated in Denver. They're all held through different LLCs, so nobody's lease really says Highlands Real Estate Investment Trust. It'll say things like Champa Street Lofts LLC. They have a few of these on Champa Street downtown, some loft properties. There's two more on Detroit over near East High School. There's the Kenilworth Courts at like 16th and Downing, Innocent 44 in Northwest Denver, and a couple others scattered around. And what's interesting is a lot of these have quite bad reviews, which was something that jumped out at me as I was looking into this. When you look into the reviews of these buildings, a lot of the complaint, reasonable complaint, fires, theft, very lax response to needs from the superintendent, all sorts of maintenance stuff. That stuff that probably realistically falls on property management, not on Highlands REIT, who owns the building. But the fact is, the Highlands REIT is paying Cornerstone to manage all of their apartments in Denver, and they don't seem particularly concerned by the fact that these average about 1.8 stars.
Journalist Logan M. Davis, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me.
You can read Davis's report into the landlord behind the Hudson ICE Detention Center at ColoradoTimesReporter.com. He was speaking with KGNU's Abby O'Brien. That report was shared with us via Rocky Mountain Community Radio, a coalition of public media stations that includes KVNF. This summer's vast wildfires have left many Coloradans wary. And that fear shows up not just in how we react to wildfires, but in the words we use to describe them.
When we speak about fire, commonly we use negative language. We use scar, we use scorched, we use words that have high emotional value, typically negatively.
Kevin Sweeney is a public information officer working on the Gold Mountain Fire. While showing KVNF containment lines, he stops us before we get too close to a blackened tree. He points out a flag that says "Killer Tree," indicating that it could easily fall. In these situations, harsh language can be useful. A negative term like burn scar helps people understand that the area is dangerous. But outside those immediate safety warnings, Sweeney says that same language can shape how people think about every kind of fire, including the prescribed burns that help reduce future wildfire risk.
One of the hurdles we have to get over with getting more beneficial fire on the landscape is reducing the fear of fire in our communities. We need more fire in the West. And that's a really hard thing to say when you're driving through a 40,000-acre fire that almost burned down a town that I got married in.
Instinct tells us that fires need to be put out immediately. But when it comes to wildfires, the answer isn't quite so simple.
If you think back to when pioneers were moving across the land, and then later on, fire bad, don't ever have it because European settlers were coming from places where fires, they only burned downtowns. Whereas our Ute friends and our other native friends, they would come up into these lands and hunt and then migrate down into lower valleys, but they would light fires behind them when they left so that they could have good hunting grounds. And so there is this balance and understanding of the importance of value of fire. And where we have been for the past 150 years with the mindset of put every fire out is why we have a Gold Mountain Fire, why we have a Dixie Fire, why we have a Paradise Campfire. It's because of our fear of fire instead of understanding how fire is a natural part of this place.
Sweeney recognizes that changing the way people think or speak about fire isn't easy, especially after a summer like this.
Living without fire here is the same as living without snow. If we eliminate fire, we dramatically impact the landscape and we dramatically turn it for the worse. So just like we don't really want to stop the snow, we don't really want to stop the fire. But it's really uncomfortable to say that when we're so close to it having a potential tremendously negative impact.
For Sweeney, changing how we manage fire starts with changing how we talk about it. Because if every fire is seen only as destructive, he says it becomes much harder to use carefully planned fires that can help prevent the next disaster. That story was part of a KVNF series on the Gold Mountain Fire. Stay tuned in the coming days for more reporting on firefighting personnel and the work that comes after the fire is out. That's your KVNF Regional Newscast. I'm Audra McCabe.